Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, there have been more twists and turns surrounding health policy this summer than a boomerang roller coaster at Six Flags. I haven't been there lately, but I hear it's a pretty wild ride. The Senate's recent marathon to end Obamacare came up one vote short after no small amount of high drama over the Senate repeal and replace efforts.
A marathon voterama took place in the Senate after Senator John McCain cast a decisive vote to allow the discussion on the GOP replacement bill to continue. Recently diagnosed with an aggressive form of brain cancer, that decision was met with quite a bit of derision, Mark, many viewing the timing as ironic, considering the bill would take health care away from millions of Americans.
After a whirlwind couple of days of discussion, it was clear that a handful of female Republican senators were holding steadfast to their conviction. Mm-hmm. And they were certainly vowing not to support the GOP proposal, which would have gutted Obamacare protections for huge sectors of the population and would have led to a real loss of insurance coverage for tens of millions of Americans.
And in a dramatic final vote, once again, it was Senator John McCain who cast the deciding vote, I think surprising the Senate and the GOP leadership by joining ranks with Republican Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. They all voted no on the Senate bill and essentially killed the effort. While the White House and the Congress can still do much to undermine support for Medicaid as well as for the subsidies for those buying insurance on the individual market, the GOP effort to kill Obamacare has signaled yet another victory for supporters of the Affordable Care Act, which has certainly run a gauntlet of legal and legislative changes almost from the moment it was passed, Mark.
And there are now a bipartisan group that has formed in the House. 40 House members joined the so-called Problem Solver Caucus. It's being led by Republican Congressman from New York, Tom Reed, and they're working on a variety of legislative fixes for the Affordable Care Act, which both parties agree is called for. It'd be interesting to see what outcomes this bipartisan effort has, Margaret.
And in the meantime, the healthcare industry continues its transition into the digital world, and there are some serious growing pains around health information technology. And that brings us to our guest today. Dr. Don Rucker is the National Coordinator for Health IT at the Department of Health and Human Services, and he is dedicated to bringing a more Silicon Valley-like approach to health IT.
He brings tremendous cachet to the position, and we're looking forward to that conversation.
Lori Robertson will stop by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our radio shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Donald Rucker in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Bipartisan momentum seems to be underway in Washington in the wake of the failure to pass a GOP repeal and replace bill in Congress. In the House, a bipartisan group of some 40 lawmakers has been meeting privately to hash out workable solutions to some of the lingering problems with the Affordable Care Act. Led by Republican Congressman Tom Reed of New York and Democrat Josh Gottenheimer of New Jersey, the so-called Problem Solver Caucus is signaling a willingness to reach out across the aisle for policy initiatives that stand a chance of making it through the legislative process. Their first order of business, stabilize the insurance marketplaces across the country. The bipartisan working group also wants to change Obamacare's employer mandate so that it applies only to companies with more than 500 workers. The Trump administration has threatened to cut off the cost-sharing subsidies already in place for this year's insurance purchasers, subsidies millions of Americans receive to offset the cost of purchasing health insurance on the marketplace. The insurance industry has been lobbying hard against cutting off those funds. Such a move would force them to lose money based on this year's rate setting and to dramatically hike costs to offset those losses next year. Meanwhile, the chairman of the U.S. Health Committee urged President Trump to drop his threat to cut those government subsidy payments to insurers that make Obamacare plans affordable. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander said his committee would begin bipartisan hearings on stabilizing the individual health insurance market the week of September 4th and urged fellow lawmakers to fund the cost-sharing subsidies for at least another year. For the first time in history, the Food and Drug Administration is planning to regulate and reduce the amount of nicotine in cigarettes to levels they deem non-addictive. The target reduction is 95%, a measure that anti-smoking activists have been advocating since 1994. Studies have shown smokers given less potent cigarettes did indeed smoke less and showed fewer signs of addiction than smokers using conventional cigarettes. It's the first full solar eclipse to come along in four decades, and it's cause for concern for some ophthalmologists and scientists who study these things. Millions of Americans have purchased disposable glasses designed to allow people to watch the eclipse directly, but officials are warning there may be counterfeits from China and elsewhere that don't meet the stringent requirements for sun gazing. Totality will be visible only from a ribbon of land that stretches across the U.S. The rest of the country will only see a partial eclipse. Officials are issuing stern warnings that even casual glancing at a crescent of the sun during the event could cause permanent eye damage, even blindness. NASA has been urging people to buy eclipse glasses from a small group of companies whose products are known to conform to international standards. You can find the recommended brands on the NASA website. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health Information Technology at the Department of Health and Human Services. He previously served as a clinical professor of emergency medicine and biomedical informatics at Ohio State University and was chief medical officer at Siemens Healthcare USA. He started his informatics career at Datamedic Corporation, where he co-developed the world's first Microsoft Windows-based electronic medical record. Dr. Rucker earned his undergraduate degree at Harvard College, his MBA and master's in medical computer science at Stanford, and his medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Dr. Rucker, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You know, I think it's fair to say we love talking to the coordinators for ONC. We've had Vindel Washington on, Karen DeSalvo, Farsad Mastashari, and going back to David Braler, 13 years ago when President George W. Bush created the office. And there has been so much that's happened in our world. Now you sit in that seat. And I wonder if you could talk about the current state of health IT in this country, what you want to accomplish in terms of reducing physician burden or enabling consumer access to their data.
Yeah, I think when we sort of look at, you know, the timeline, Mark, that you've just outlined, most clinicians, almost all hospitals have the records electronically. There are really two big issues that have percolated up. Congress, with the Cures Act, it's top of mind for Secretary Price. And one issue is just these systems are difficult to use, mm-hmm. part of which is an EHR issue, part of which is really the broader surround. The second issue is people sort of thought that all of this would sort of electronically communicate, right? Our smartphones communicate a lot better than it has. This is something that in the IT world we call interoperability. Mm-hmm. So that burden reduction, usability, and interoperability are really the two big go-forward challenges that you know, we're focused on.
Well, Dr. Rucker, you've experienced these inherent challenges of health information technology from a lot of different angles, certainly as a practicing ER physician and an internist, I understand. As a technology developer, you've made your mark on the corporate side, all big accomplishments. So you've had a very front row seat at all of these intersecting points in the health IT landscape. What are these inherent design challenges in building high-functioning health IT systems, and how will that experience and that knowledge inform your efforts at ONC?
So I think there are many, many sort of usability issues that sort of get wrapped up in the colloquial, I hate my EMR. Some of it just starts with interfaces, rules, including some of the meaningful use rules. A lot of it is around reimbursement. What does it take to code a level 4 or 5 visit? Quality reporting is a big new one. Everybody says, well, I can use my, you know, ATM card and pick your remote corner of the world. But ultimately, that's a number. That's a relatively straightforward thing to compute about. We're talking about human biology, which, as we know from DNA sequencing, is inherently unique. So when you look at interoperability, I think we've had some good progress in data originally generated by a machine. So data, for example, from lab analyzers, CAT scanners or MRI, that type of information, I think we've had a pretty good run on. Data that requires human organization, a problem list. So I think that's, think about the interoperability. And then, of course, with interoperability, you're solving for technical issues. You're solving for workflow issues all simultaneously. The problem is they sort of have a multiplier effect.
Dr. Rucker, the Office of National Coordinator is tasked with a pretty heavy lift, helping the industry build interoperable, private and secure nationwide health information infrastructure. And you say that if we're going to achieve that goal, we need to strip away various regulations and reporting requirements that overburden healthcare providers because of the critical time it takes away from face-to-face interactions with patients. You've also talked about on the side of the payers, this issue of bulk accountability or institutional accountability, which is to allow payers access to data via APIs with the goal of promoting more market competition. I'm wondering how easy is that burden to reduce while at the same time improve capacity for better flow of health data?
Well, I think there are really sort of two separate questions. And so one is the documentation concerns and how it might one address those. The second is the interface API concerns for institutional accountability.
Yes.
Right. So I see those as two separate things. We're working heavily with CMS, and Secretary Price has a lot of efforts going on to try to reduce provider burden. So we're looking at what collectively we can reduce. That's sort of where we are on the first.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth understanding for people, though, a lot of these things, including, for example, even the level 4 and 5 codes, came because of Medicare's fiduciary responsibilities to avoid fraud and abuse. And I think we just have to understand from a taxpayer and a budget point of view, there's a yin and a yang to these regs. I think HHS has to balance those two things.
Well, Dr. Rucker, you had a recent press briefing, and you noted at it that while the standing mission still remains intact at the Office of the National Coordinator, there are two pieces of legislation that will provide important guideposts for your efforts moving forward. One is the passage of MACRA, and the other is the 21st Century Cures Act, which earmarks, I think, almost $7 billion for cancer research, more rapid drug and device development. Talk with us about these initiatives and how you envision them shifting the landscape as well as the mission at ONC and any other payment reforms underway help support that goal of the colloquial interoperability, as you say.
Okay. The MACRA law, right, is the law that replaces the annual doc fix, the sustainable growth rate mandated reduction in provider payments. This puts that onto a more permanent basis. It also took the outpatient Medicare meaningful use and wrapped it into the merit-based incentive program provisions of MACRA. There the issue really becomes how do medical records support quality measure reporting. CMS has a number of quality programs that Congress has passed a number of laws over the years in the move from volume to value in payment. You know, the concerns there, of course, are there's some different regulatory requirements, there's some complexities in reporting. So that's the MACRA part of the side of ONC's responsibility. The 21st Century Cures Act has a number of different provisions. I would say the big areas for the Office of the National Coordinator are definitions of what is interoperability, what is information blocking, and what are open APIs. So API is Application Programming Interface, and that is really the software front end, if you will, or the software door into a system's data. Now, mind you, like real doors, there are keys and security and authentication and, you know, the fact that it's a door doesn't mean you just get to enter, but it is a door with a computable address. So those are big things in the Cures Act. Each of those things needs definitions because there's a lot of complexity to that, as you can sort of tell we're really working off of three use cases there. One is, can patients, individual consumers, mm-hmm. access their medical record by just pointing their app at their provider's URL and with the appropriate authentication, get their data for themselves, right? You know, to always get your data by logging onto a provider portal that may also tie you into providers, you know, where you would potentially want to be able to get providers to compete for your business. The second use case is, since most care in the U.S. is actually not purchased by individuals, but purchased in large amounts by companies, agencies, can they, with contractual protections, get data efficiently from providers in volume, right? So if I'm XYZ Motor Company and I would like to see the quality of care at five hospitals, can I get that, or do I have to go in and try to sign something for everyone, you know, have a huge amount of work to do that? With open APIs, you should be able to do that. The third use case is just really the details of what an open API is. I would encourage your listeners to think of them in sort of two classes. The first class is simply, what does that look like on a vendor, right? So if you buy your software product from a commercial vendor, what does the ability to have an open API look like? And then what does that look like from a provider? So if I'm a practice, I'm a hospital, and somebody says, where's your open API? What does that look like? So that's how we're working through both MIPS, MACRA to start with, and the Cures Act.
We're speaking today with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health Information Technology at the Department of Health and Human Services. You've noted healthcare needs to take a more Silicon Valley approach to developing systems. And we spent a lot of time, a lot of effort, and I think many providers would still feel it's more like Death Valley rather than Silicon Valley. And I'm wondering if you could just...
The harsh comparison,
well,
but probably true.
Unfortunately, I think we and I'm wondering if you could describe the trajectory that you see by engaging that ethos into your approach and how you hope that will inform the process moving forward.
Well, healthcare, you know, doesn't really sit in a competitive market economy. Over the last 50-odd years of Medicare, we've entirely decoupled what would in microeconomics be efficient decisions, where price equals marginal cost equals marginal utility, right? Mm-hmm. So when Medicare started setting prices, every single part of the efficient frontier of providing goods and services was uncoupled from efficiency by artificially set prices. So now we've had literally decades and decades of this. So when we look at, let's say, a Silicon Valley kind of thing, we're looking at it from a very, very funny historical perspective. We're not really looking at it from a pure market, the way that a Uber or a Facebook or a Google or an Apple. We're looking at it from this funny kind of policy-generated world, because I think it's important to understand that, right? Because the deficit is fundamentally the lack of market information about efficient resources through market prices. It's not a deficit of IT. But when you look at the Silicon Valley approach, a lot more small mobile devices, right, as opposed to desktops, a lot of creativity about how things are being put together. One example might be Google Maps. If you look at the number of apps that you have on your smartphone that somehow use Google Maps, mm-hmm. right? Think of all the apps that somewhere in there, whether it's a hotel or finding a bank, where mapping tools come in, right? So they're pointing to a URL and they're getting a map back, right? So that's a open API is in a Silicon Valley sense. Now, obviously in healthcare, there'll be some authentication of that. There'd actually be a contract. But if it's something flyweight, patients should be able to access it and do with it as they desire. That is, in fact, the current law under HIPAA. Right now, I think there's a divide where you have lots of health apps designed by Silicon Valley, but almost none of these actually have access to what I would call medical data, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, they can access your Fitbit, and that's
Interesting. But.
If you're, you know, an intense 23-year-old, but if you're a 65-year-old with four or five comorbid medical conditions and a lot of chronic abnormal lab results, what you really want to access is your clinical information.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're not seeing that in the app space.
Well, Don, you really hold kind of a unique, or you do hold a very unique role. One, you have to build a better health IT infrastructure for the country and providers and institutions, but also really help patients better navigate the health IT world. And when you said, patients really want access to their clinical records, I was going to add, yes, and they'd like a PS that says, and here's what it means to you. Tell us about maybe some of the initiatives that you see really having an impact on the consumer user experience while interfacing with health IT, and what are the strategies that are actually going to drive these consumers?
Well, I think Congress has made it over the last 10, 15 years, I think, is trying to get people back into the spirit of shopping for healthcare. And private payers are sort of almost being forced to do the same thing as well, right? And we see this with high deductible health plans, HSA, health savings accounts, where collectively anybody who's with a private sector employer has higher deductibles and greater personal out-of-pocket risk. And so right now it's very difficult for consumers to shop because I think for a variety of reasons, pricing is not transparent.
Yeah.
But I think as people shop and ask, there will be some progress made there. So I think on the consumer side, it's really the need and the incentives to shop with your high-deductible health plan. You know, consumer behavior is pretty powerful. America's built on it.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the entire brick-and-mortar landscape, totally physically transformed by electronic shopping, right? I mean, every mall in America, to the extent they're still around, looks different. Airlines, banking, pick your industry, all of these have been transformed. So I think healthcare is ripe for that. What are the missing ingredients? Obviously, that's speculation. The other part that's out here, of course, are API standards that make this easier to write code against some of these EMRs. Every EMR has some internal representation, right? There is no general global model of what all clinical data look like, right? So nobody knows everything in healthcare. So every system represents the internal data differently. What can we do about uniformity of some of these interfaces to get part of that information out? That's the way you're going to be able to get real clinical information that fuels insights, decision support, and can support consumer behaviors.
You know, I was thinking, Don, as you were talking earlier about the doors and reminding people that they weren't necessarily doors that you could just easily get into. But the fact of the matter is, what we're seeing around the globe is that there are enormous breaches of health IT systems. And the recent WannaCry malware attack crippled the national health system in the UK, and there are many other examples. And I think they're wondering how prepared is the United States health system to deal with this issue of data privacy and security?
You know, I tend to think of security more broadly than healthcare, because there's lots of valuable data. So I try to think of it more from a computer science point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you do programming, when you set up systems, it is really a cat and mouse game. I mean, this is inherent tension between good and evil there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are a number of very solid practices on data, on encryption. I mean, we know a lot about security. And when you look at a lot of the ransomware, those things are going into known breaches. But again, I think collectively have to keep our guard up and make the investments in these systems and the system designs to really protect the information. I don't think there's a magic bullet here.
Mm-hmm. We've been speaking today with Dr. Donald Rucker, National Coordinator for Health IT at the Department of Health and Human Services. You can learn more about their work by going to healthit.gov or follow them on Twitter at @ONC_HealthIT. Don, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump said on Twitter that, quote, bailouts for insurance companies would end very soon if Congress didn't pass a new health care bill. Senator Susan Collins said the payments aren't a bailout, quote, but rather help people who are very low income afford their out-of-pocket costs. Trump actually distorts the facts in calling them bailouts. These payments, which do go directly to insurance companies, are made to reduce out-of-pocket costs for those who earn between 100% and 250% of the federal poverty level. These payments are called cost-sharing subsidies or cost-sharing reductions, and they are different from the premium tax credits that reduce monthly premiums for those earning between 100% and 400% of the poverty level. Those eligible for premium tax credits can choose to receive the credit in advance to immediately lower the monthly premium or claim the credit the following year on a tax return or a combination. The cost-sharing subsidies, meanwhile, are only available in advance. The payment goes to the insurers to lower the out-of-pocket costs, including deductibles, copays, and coinsurance. The Affordable Care Act puts caps on the amount policyholders could be required to spend out-of-pocket under their insurance plans. The cost-sharing subsidy lowers that cap. Those who qualify automatically get a choice of plans that include those reduced out-of-pocket caps. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said that 10.3 million people had signed up and paid for marketplace plans early this year, and 57% of them received cost-sharing subsidies. That's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. For all the people in the world without limbs, acquiring prosthetics can be costly and out of reach. It's especially challenging to make prosthetics for children, since they are in constant state of growth. Rochester Institute of Technology scientist Dr. John Shule stumbled upon a clever and affordable solution, provided online open source templates to anyone anywhere in the world who has access to a 3D printer, and provide prosthetic hands for next to nothing.
If you have a 3D printer and you'd like to help, put yourself on this map. And if you know someone who needs a hand, put yourself on this map.
So he founded the Enable Network, which has massed thousands of volunteer makers in upwards of 40 countries around the world, providing cheap but functional prosthetics for children in need.
I think we're currently pushing 5,800 identified members in our Google Plus community. We know that we've delivered about 800 hands devices, and we suspect that a comparable number have been downloaded by people we can't track because we put all of our design on the internet.
The simple limb designs have become more sophisticated as recipients of the prosthetic devices provide feedback for designers to make more efficient devices.
We're still working on opposable thumbs. We're still working on individual finger movements. These things grip or ungrip. That's all they do. So they're much less functional than a biological hand, and they're also less functional than a fancy myoelectric hand. But for kids, it's huge, because those expensive devices are typically out of reach for children who would outgrow them. And, you know, our hands don't even pretend to look like regular hands. They look like superhero Iron Man hands, and for that very reason, they're very popular with kids.
Enable, a global collaborative network of open source designs, linking to makers with 3D printers to provide low-cost prosthetic limbs to children and adults around the world who might otherwise not be able to afford them. Now that's a bright idea.